dying, Father. He's asking me. Ever since I was a child, I had a feeling that something is missing in me. I want to know why I am here. Can any of us know that?
Become yourself. Name God and the devil don't matter.
I want to learn. I want to understand. Be careful. Can you find the force to enable these two quite opposite lives to live together in yourself? At any moment, the wolf can devour the lamb.
And you must learn what it means to become responsible.
This is an exact life. And that is why you are here.
Gentlemen, welcome back. We are delighted to have you with us today. My name is Henrik, and this is Red Ice Radio. We are going to continue our quest in search for answers to some of the most intriguing questions. Who are we? Where do we come from? Where are we going? And who is really in charge? Josh Reeves is a Dallas, Texas-based researcher, filmmaker, and radio talk show host. He has made several documentaries and mini-documentaries, his latest being The Lost Secrets of Ancient America. We will begin to discuss the ancient wall in Rockwall, Texas, which the town is named after, and who the ancient and mysterious peoples who inhabited the Americas long before the rise of colonial America or natives might have been. We'll talk about mysterious mounds in various states, similar myths, giant skeletons, and the stories surrounding them. Welcome back, Josh. It's great to have you on the program once again. I hope you're well and that everything is good down in Texas with you.
It's great. I'm glad to be back here with you, Henrik, and it's always fun when we do shows together, and I'm excited to talk about what we're going to be talking about today here with my new film and all the subject matter that this entails. So, ready to get into it with you.
Great. Yeah, great job on the new film. It's a topic that is one, I think, is one of the most exciting for me at the moment, mankind's, true history and the eerie strangeness of the ancient world and the possibility of giants, snake people. I mean, it's all over the place when you begin to really get into it and you understand how much of our history has been covered up. It's just amazing, and you do a great job in covering some of this, of course, in terms of the Smithsonian and some of the other academia. We'll get into that a little bit later, but tell us, Josh, how you got onto this track. As people who listen to the show and your show obviously know that you've done the films The Secret Ride and all that, and this is a, well, it's a leap in another direction, if you will. So how did you get into this?
Well, actually, you know, this is something that I've wanted to do for a great many years. I found out about the subject initially and started working on this project long before I ever had a radio show or long before I'd ever even done a film or anything else. I mean, at this stage, when I first found out about the information pertaining to this film, The Lost Secrets of Ancient America, I at that point was just an activist. I was somebody who was, you know, still trying to learn as much as I could. I wasn't somebody yet. I wanted to be active and I wanted to do something. But at that point, I really didn't know how to do it. So I was really just being, you know, doing activist stuff, being out in the streets, passing out DVDs, doing 9/11 truth stuff. And in 2004, I was reading this book by Jim Mars called The Rule by Secrecy. And if you haven't read that book, or people haven't read that book, it's a great primer. Yeah, it's a great one to give to people who are kind of new to this information. Or any of this information, because it covers so much, such a wide scope, and everything from the banking system to ancient Sumerian stuff, it goes all over the place. And so it's a great primer for people who may be new to this information. So I was reading that, and at the end of one of the chapters there, Jim Mars says, maybe one day we'll have answers to all these questions of these various mysteries, and he named off a few, and then he said, the ancient mysterious wall in Rockwall, Texas. And it was, my hair just stood up on my arms, and the reason that is because my entire life growing up around the suburbs and areas outside of Dallas, Texas here, I've had a couple of strange occurrences happen around the area where the rock wall is back when I was a teenager and back in the 90s and stuff, long before I ever knew about any of this stuff. And friends of mine had similar experiences. And to give you examples of some of those experiences, specifically two that happened to me, one was an incident back in the early 90s with me and my one of my best friends who worked with me on the film as well. We were going to work in Dallas, and we were going across a bridge across Lake Ray Hubbard where part of the wall is now buried underneath it. And we left to go to work at like noon, and when we got across the second bridge, it seemed like we had been gone maybe, 10 or 15 minutes, and we stopped to get gas, and we got out, and we looked at the clock, and it was like 5 o'clock. And we were like, how is it 5 o'clock? How are we late? We left, and it only seemed like 15 or 20 minutes had gone, and really what had happened is we experienced some sort of missing time of it. And then another incident, we were out near the rock wall area, and we were near an old power plant, and we were just, in our early 20s, and we were out there late at night just looking for a place to hang out. And we went by this area that's near the lake near Rockwall, and we got hit. I can't describe this any other way. We got hit by some sort of spiritual force that knocked us out and made us both black out, and then we were basically, two grown men crying our eyes out in tears, traumatized, because some sort of energy, to this day we don't know what it was, it hit us. And really knocked us on our rear ends, and we didn't know what it was. And for years, we had friends that had, stories of seeing UFO sightings a lot around this area. So again, when I was reading the Jim Marr stuff, it clicked like a light bulb. I said, I have to uncover this. I have to find out what this is about. And so fast forward a few years, 2007, I made my first film, and I started doing my radio show then. And immediately when I first started, like the second or third show I ever did is when I found out about the Council for National Policy stuff. And so I was really on that area of things up until probably around right after the last time we spoke, Henrik, last time I was on the show last year. And so I've been off and on, even though I've been working on this project for years. It's almost a 10-year thing, but it's just now culminating in this first film, which is really not all there is to say. And this is an open investigation. This is really just the introduction to this. But I'm excited to tell people that, as far as what you can know about the rock wall up to this point, everything there is to know that we know and we have data for right now is in this film. So that was really the main genesis for this for me, Henrik, in the beginning, was this thing where I felt like, there was some reason that I was supposed to find out about this. And so I've kind of made it my personal mission to uncover this thing.
Let's talk about Rockwall. Let's begin there. This is where you begin the film. For those who don't know, tell us where and, of course, what it is, Josh.
Well, what the Rockwall is it's actually it's a structure that is buried underneath the town of Rockwall, Texas. It was discovered in the 1800s when a lot of the locals were first coming into the area and setting up their farms. You had two gentlemen initially who first moved into the area that were Freemasons, and I thought this was very strange that they had come from, one came from Virginia, one came from Tennessee, and they just landed in this spot where eventually became Rockwall. And so they didn't really have any farming communities or anything like that set up. They had, just some little habitations and things, and about a year later you started to have people coming in from different areas setting up farming communities. And so you had three or four men, this is all detailed in the film, you had three or four men who started setting up farms, they started setting up water wells, and they were all sort of starting the town at the same time, so they were arguing over what they wanted to call it. One wanted to call it after his last name, of course, other guy wanted to name it after himself, and so eventually when they started digging these water wells, every one of them, every time they would try to dig down to get some groundwater, they would hit this stone structure. And so one of the gentlemen came over to the other farmer, to the Wade farm, and said, the darndest thing, I'm trying to get water back here, and every time I do, I get down to the bottom and I hit this stone. We can't seem to get water. And all the guys had that problem, so they excavated part of this thing, and dug it out and were confused as to what it was and why it was there. And so they called the local masons, Mr. Heath and Mr. Barnes, and those were the guys who settled the town. They came in, they took one look at this thing immediately and saw that through the stonework and the way that it was put together with this mortar that looked as if it was smoothed perfectly with a trowel, they immediately recognized this as being the work of a stonemason. So this is when they declared to the people who had set up the farming communities, look, you know, you guys are going to have to all eat crow on this one. None of you can name it after yourselves because this is absolute proof right here that somebody was here long before us. And that is where the idea that this structure was actually built by someone way back in antiquity really first took root and really first became this idea of this being something that wasn't a natural formation.
There's been some wild stories, obviously, what this is, where it comes from, some of the consequent excavations. I think there's records going back to the 1800s on this, and we can run through some of them if you want to, Josh. I mean, you have a great portion of this about what Sam Slick tells about in some of his, I think there's some of his letters. Tell us about who this character is and what he said about all of this.
Well, specifically what we discuss in the film are some reports from, and this is really where I started. I started looking at, okay, let's go look at the news reports. What were, you know, what was being said about the rock wall and all this stuff when it was first discovered. And there are several news reports from a local rock wall newspaper that is no longer in existence that was called the Rock Wall Success. And they printed three different stories with a gentleman who used the pseudonym of Sam Slick that described the first story, and this is all detailed in the film. The first story that they ran was about a giant skull that was found out near Rockwall in a town that's now called Heath, which subsequently I just found out recently by reading a story in the newspaper locally here. That area where they initially found the giant skeletons and where they found some of these subterranean caverns and whatnot that is described by Sam Slick in these newspaper articles, that whole area now, which I didn't even know, has been completely taken over by the Church of Latter-day Saints, the Mormons.
Really?
And I just thought that was fascinating when you take a look at this information and the implications of it. And so they printed this story about the giant skeleton. They told people could come down and check it out. People did. And then apparently there was two other stories ran where they talked about finding this abode, what they called an abode of a giant that was out near there, and they made the declaration in this paper that this was no question, this was no doubt, this was the guy who built the rock wall. Now, I don't believe that, and I don't believe that to be true now, but I definitely think there is certainly a connection to this, and one has to do with the other. But the interesting thing about the Sam Slick thing is this has been a big point of contention for people who have researched the rock wall stuff, because people said, well, you know, this is all got to be BS because this guy, Sam Slick, was just a satirical writer from Canada. He wrote all these stories of nonsense and big tall tales and blah, blah, blah. And that's what people liked to do back then. They just liked to tell tales. And that's not the impression that you get when you talk to the old timers, when you talk to people who were, you know, 80, 90 years old and they say, no, you know, there's people didn't do that back then. People were, you know, a lot more stand up and didn't want, you know, they didn't like people telling lies.
Yeah.
And so I think that's why this guy used this name Sam Slick, because come to find out, after I started investigating this guy, this guy died years and years and years before these Sam Slick articles pertaining to the rock wall and the giants were printed. So obviously this was somebody else who was trying to use this name to keep themselves from being, basically that's the thing is that when you printed stuff like that back then, people, you know, initially if you didn't have proof, people would lynch you. You know, people were really, really, really adamant about the truth and wanted the truth to be in papers, and it was a powerful force of media back then. And so I think that's why this guy basically used this fake name. But come to find out, subsequently, after the third story was printed, the Rockwall Success newspaper was bought out, and no more stories pertaining to any of this stuff was ever printed in Rockwall ever again. So it's a fascinating part of this where, you know, it really made me suspicious of the people who had tried to completely assign this thing of Giants as being BS because of this Sam Slick thing, and that really being their only proof. So that was one of the places I started, Henrik, as far as my research, because essentially what it was is I started out in the investigation. I try to give people sort of the methodology of how I approach this in the film. I try to kind of sequence the film in that way. And so the way that I approached the research initially was, okay, here's this Rockwall. I want to find out anything I can find out about it. And I started meeting with people who had researched it previously. One gentleman in particular I met in 2008, John Lindsay, who's done the most extensive stuff on the wall in the past, you know, 50 years or whatever. He's done it. He's done an archaeological dig. He's been there. He's got a lot of analysis on this. So I went to his house and met with him and got all of his information as far as the makeup of the rock wall, which we can talk about as well if you like. And so the initial thing was, okay, this is the information that says, obviously, this is not a natural formation. Obviously, this was built by somebody. So as soon as we established that, then my next step was, okay, well, who could it have been? And so once we had the thing established with Giants, these reports of Giants, I started saying, okay, well, what else have we had in the United States that might match these reports? And to my surprise, I mean, there are literally thousands of them. Yeah, I mean, I detail a great many of them in the film, but I still don't even scratch the surface as far as how many of these reports there have been. And so one of the things that I kept finding over and over again with these giant skeletons was their appearance around what they call mounds. And so I wanted to find out if there were, obviously, mounds found in Rockwall. And the interesting thing about it is I found out that there are 13 known mounds in Rockwall County, and I can't find one of them. And I can't find anybody that knows anywhere location where they're at. Because a lot of people that do know about it, they don't tell people where it is. I've got a good idea where a couple of them are at. They now have houses and stuff built on them. But once I established that and established that there was elevation changes that are not normal to this area, that's when I started saying, okay, let's go and look and look all over the place and see where else this has happened. And, of course, you know, there is a lot of evidence that of mounds, giants, and everything else, not just in Rockwall and not just in America, but really all over the world.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, there's incredible many connections here between these complexes from a European perspective. As soon as I see some of this, it's like this is exactly what you have in England and other parts of Europe as well. We know that they're worldwide, of course, in Asia. And I don't know how much is in Africa, actually, in terms of these mounds, though. But nonetheless, there has been excavations, as you say, into the mounds. There have been skeletons dug up, and these are giant skeletons. These are skulls that can fit over a regular human's head. I mean, it's incredible, and yet at the same time, today we have you cover the old news stories, the old reporting from 1800s and forward that shows the genuine reality of giants. But slowly and slowly, this has become covered up. It's become something of a joke. There's been tons of fake images released, specifically in the online world now, which kind of also automatically discredits all these ancient stories. But I think you're doing the right thing by going actually back to the old stories and getting the real score from there. And it's amazing. It's all over America.
Well, it is, and that's the interesting thing that I find as well that I don't know if I really was able to iterate in this first volume of the film, but certainly will in later volumes. But the interesting thing to me is I find that the farther that you go back in these reports, and really some of the ones that I cover in the film are really just the past, few hundred years. But when you start to go farther and farther back into these reports, like there's some in France from like the 1400s where they were finding, they found a 32-foot skeleton. The farther that you seem to go back in history, the larger that these skeletons seem to be. It's, I find that just highly interesting. But you're exactly right. I mean, there is so much misinformation, disinformation, blatant lies, Photoshop pictures. I mean, there's just so much of this, and it's really cognitive dissonance, as you mentioned, to get people thinking that it's all BS, when in reality you've got, as with any of this stuff, you've got BS mixed with truth, and so you have to sort of go in and get through what is what. But what I found was, again, as I mentioned earlier, just the most interesting was that in almost every single case of these giant skeletons being found, in an overwhelming amount of the cases, you have them being found inside of these mounds. And that was the interesting thing about the mounds to me, is that most people assume that when they see one of these ancient mounds, or they go to one of these, you know, state parks or something in the United States where these are located, I think oftentimes the misconception is that's put out is that these mounds are strictly burial mounds. And that's not the case in every case. Certainly some of them do contain burials, but these mounds also serve a multiple purpose. In some cases they are burial mounds. In some cases they are ceremonial mounds. In some cases they're both. And that's what I think is highly interesting about it. And one of the things I detail in the film is the really what the ceremonial usages of these mounds were, and how strange it seems that the traditions about the afterlife and how it pertains to these mounds and these rituals is mirrored exactly to traditions that come from Egypt and the Middle East and all the rest of it. The alignments line up the same. And so that's when you start to realize that, you know, if there's nothing to this giant thing, then why is it that the people who inhabited the areas around where these giant skeletons and these mounds are found all seem to have this information and knowledge that we can trace directly back to ancient Mesopotamia?
Yeah, indeed. It's really, really interesting. And I think, well, let's talk actually a little bit about how big the complex is, what the Rockwall is made up of, because it's kind of, in the past, when these archaeological excavations have been made, there seems to be some kind of confusion. Is it actually covering up something? Is it kind of from a center being tentacled outwards? There's other, seems to be other parts of it too that has to do with these rumors about this subterranean temple, if you will, that are found. I want to get your take on the reality of that, the possibility of that. They found some, you know, black marble pillars in there, an iron chest, and these giant axes and pots and stuff like that. What do you think about that story?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a good question, Henrik. I mean, honestly, for my inclusion of that stuff in the data is really just for the inclusion of trying to get, you know, completion and trying to get all of the important data in there. But I think that, you know, it's one of those things where without the proof of it, you know, without even seeing it yourself, it's hard to 100% take it as the truth. But
sure. Yeah.
But when you weigh it against the other data, when you weigh it against the other finds that have been found outside of Rockwall, as I mentioned earlier, when you weigh it against other things that have been found, and when you weigh it against these finds from the Middle East where they found, you know, that they have the 25-foot iron bed of Og the Giant in a museum, mm-hmm. you know. So
yeah.
That's to me, that's the thing where you have to stay rational in looking at the facts, but you also can't just allow yourself to be carried away by what the mainstream consensus is trying to tell you is the truth on these things. And that's why I encourage people, when they watch the film, to sort of, you know, have an open mind about all of these things and don't so much try to read in everything that you think you know about the facts into the information, because oftentimes you find things that completely blow that away. But as far as the structure of the rock wall and all these other things connected to it, the one thing I find time and time again is that you have the rock wall, but then you also have what seem to be other structures around it. You also seem to have things very near to the wall and almost as if the wall was built onto it. You have some of these things that do appear to be natural formations. And you have all this existing simultaneously within each other, in the rock wall. And so what's happened through the years, whenever there's been any sort of archaeological excavations done, they've all been done at different locations. None of them have been conducted at the same spot. And so what's happened is that one archaeological site will be conducted here, and it will have that specific phenomenon that, you know, for all intents and purposes, when you look at it a certain way, does look like it's a natural formation. It does look like it's rock that is formed there. But when you go to another spot, you see these large flat stones that Count Byron de Prorok, the famous archaeologist, saw when he came to Rockwall in 1925, that he stated were identical to the same stones that he had seen in Carthage in North Africa and these ancient Phoenician Berber colonies in North Africa. And he was just blown away by this. And, of course, he was outside of the mainstream of archaeological finds and science and everything at his time. But when you had other archaeological sites conducted in other locations, you would have people that say, well, this is obviously natural. And that's what I found through my research, is that, yes, you do have all of this coexisting together, and that at different layers of this wall, I mean, you've got a 20-mile diameter structure, 20-mile diameter structure that's buried seven stories underground, and when you look at the layers of it, you see where, wow, this stuff down here at the bottom is really old. You can tell by the weathering on the stones. But wait a minute. This stuff up here that's only 7 or 9 feet under the ground, which is obviously still covered by, you know, eons and centuries of debris overburden and everything, it's covered up. But when you dig down about 7 to 9 feet, you start to find these larger stones that look just like the stuff that you saw in, 7,000-year-old Canaanite things in the ancient Middle East and North Africa. So that's when I started to realize that what we're dealing with here is two different types of phenomenon that has been convoluted together. So, in other words, the scientific community comes out, they already have a vested stake in not wanting this to be man-made or made by someone. So they come out, they take one look at a certain site that fits their purview, and they say, okay, that's natural, and that's it. And that standpoint of that, which was established by the Smithsonian Institute in 1927, is what stands to this day. And it's unbelievable to me, and should be unbelievable to everybody out there, that after almost 100 years, you know, no one has challenged this scientific standpoint on the rock wall, even though there is voluminous amounts of evidence to prove that you have multiple different types of phenomena. And until you have analysis and concrete documented archaeological data that is collated on multiple different sites, people are never going to know the real truth about it, because, again, there is enough anomalous things around it to bring up questions. Rock in general is not found in this area of North Texas. There is no stone, there is no natural rock anywhere found. And yet there is a disconnect where people believe that there is. But when you go and research the geology of the area and you go and research the findings, rock is an anomaly in this area, and especially when you look at what the rock wall is made up of. And I'd like to go through that, if I could, Henrik.
Definitely. It sounds a little bit like the Boston Pyramids as well, with, you know, there are different geologists that have visited the sites and they have various results and all that, and I want to try to get into a little bit more on that. What do you make of the wall, Josh? Tell us if you think it protects something. Is it trying to keep something out? Is it connected to another kind of complex with these underground temples or something else? What do you make of it?
Well, it's strange because it seems that this thing provided a variety of usages, and I think, as I mentioned just a minute ago, with the various types of material that are used in the wall, where you have, very old stones at the bottom, and then towards the top you have different building materials that are used. Basically, whatever was, the known building materials at the time you see used. So I think that you had one usage for this wall, which was way, way, way back in antiquity, which was a seawall, because you used to have the Gulf of Mexico come all the way up to where the wall is, and they know this because of the blue shale deposits that covered the wall in some sort of catastrophic event 12,000 years ago. When you get down to the bottom of the wall, you start finding shark's teeth embedded into the wall, sand dollars with fresh meat inside of them. And so it appears that at one point, the wall served one purpose. And then much later, thousands of years later, when you started to have indigenous populations and also new settlers and different things, people coming across the area, this is when you started to see the construction of some of these subterranean chambers and whatnot that run inside of the wall. Because the subterranean chamber that you're describing here, Henrik, that you've mentioned here a couple of times, this specific underground chamber system was discovered near a portion of the rock wall, the portion that was originally first discovered on the Wade family farm, which is located now in Rockwall right next to a Walmart, which I show in the film, where they have, you know, they basically throwing it in your face going, ha, 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 because they have built this Walmart, you know, with parts of the outside of it that look like the wall, but that if you go and ask anybody in Rockwall about the wall, they don't know what you're talking about. And so,
jeez, isn't that amazing? You know,
it is.
So close, and yet people have no clue. You know, I experienced this myself too in you know, various sites wherever you ask about. So yeah, it's the same around the world.
And that's the thing, and I think that's why there's been so much confusion. People think that they can just go to Rockwall and see the wall. They don't realize that it's buried. And as I said before, that goes back to this thing of there being two different types of phenomena we're dealing with. But going back to the underground structure, supposedly there was several of these underground chambers, that one which connected from the site of the old Wade farm into probably about, it's not very far up the road, it's only probably about a mile, mile and a half or so up the road to where the old Rockwall Courthouse is, and that absolutely was built on top of of what they called a temple room or a temple chamber, and there was a subterranean passageway that led up to this thing, and some gentlemen tried to go up in there and in the 1930s and made it part of the way up there, and then got spooked and were scared the whole thing was going to collapse, so they backed out of there. But my point is, Henrik, is that you have the wall itself, you have this 20-mile diameter structure, but it also appears that you have chambers, rooms. There's been pictures of that from some of the digs that John Lindsay did, where you have what he called rooms, these vaulted rooms, where you have what look like windows made out of rock. And so it appears that you had multiple different periods of habitation of this structure, which gave this structure multiple usages over millennia of time.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
As I mentioned before, you know, we have the seawall usage, and then later it was used, from according to John Lindsay, some of the evidence that he found, it appeared to him that someone was using this thing to hide from someone. And his speculation was that, you know, maybe they were using this to hide from these cannibalistic giants.
Was it always underground, though, do you think?
Well, that's the question. That's the real thing. It may not have always been underground. It may have been, but it may be so old that, you know, it eventually just got covered up with overburden and dirt and everything washed over it for years and years and years.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. There's also another tunnel system that leads from the old Rockwall Courthouse down about a mile or two down to the Trinity River. And supposedly it goes both ways. And apparently from what John Lindsay was saying, this seems to be some sort of tunnel system that someone created to be able to go from this temple dome area down to the river with water to bring water back and forth without being seen.
Hmm.
So I found that very interesting. It does make a lot of sense when you look at it. But again, you know, there's really no way for us. We don't have a historical precedent here to compare this to. So all we can really do is go by what the facts are telling us. But there's no question that when you look at the makeup of the Rockwall stones, that it was built with a high level of sophistication. And was built with a high level of sophistication, you know, way, way, way back in antiquity.
Yeah, I want to try to get to a little bit to what you think, of course, go into a little bit more of the Giants. There are many different tentacles. You've visited other places, other states as well that ties into this, and we'll get there. But I want to stay a little bit more on the Rockwall here. You said they placed the Rockwall Courthouse right on top of at least speculated where one of these complex sort of structures was, correct?
Right. It was some sort of rock, what they called a rock-lined temple room. And what's interesting about that site is you can go there now. They've actually built a new courthouse across town. And I kid you not, Henrik, this thing they built across town as their new courthouse.
A temple?
I mean, it looks like it. I'm kid you not. It looks like Solomon's Temple. I mean, it's unbelievably Masonic. I mean, as soon as I saw them start building this thing, I was just like, what are they doing here? And it's this massive structure that almost looks like a state capitol building, and yet it's just a local courthouse for a small town. You're wondering, why does a small town need, you know, Solomon's Temple for its courthouse? But the interesting thing about this temple room where the old courthouse is located is that they built sometime back in, I guess, it was about the 1950s or somewhere like that. You know, back when the scare of the Red Scare and the scare of nuclear annihilations throughout the world was going around, everybody was building nuclear fallout shelters, and there's actually a subterranean nuclear fallout shelter that's built into this old Rockwall courthouse, and it's built underground into this rock-lined chamber. So the interesting thing about that is that, you know, it seems that the people that built this courthouse, who integrated this already existing structure into the courthouse, knew something about the makeup of this stone material. It's virtually indestructible. I mean, it's made up of all these rare earth metals and minerals whose hardness is almost on the scale of a diamond. I mean, these things were built to last and built to withstand almost anything. And so it's very interesting that they utilize that for their fallout shelter, almost as if there was some knowledge that this stuff could, pretty much withstand anything.
Well, the question is, what do they know? Is it still used as a temple today? And this new building, the courthouse, is basically like a commemorative of this, whatever the origins of this thing is. I mean, I can't remember if it's the same structure or whatnot. But you also had a section in the movie where you brought up, well, basically this the cult, if you will, the initiatory cults that we can see scattered throughout the world, but possibly that it's been used for this, these caves and caverns. And I mean, it is more or less speculated the Freemasonic Brotherhood and all that basically has just lent and borrowed something from these ancient cults, basically, so we could have a kind of a continuation, if you will, on this, and it might even take place right in Rockwall. What do you think?
Well, you know, that's there certainly always has been a massive interest with Freemasonry and local Freemasonry around here and the Rockwall itself. And every time that there comes to a piece of evidence or an artifact or something like that we're trying to look at, it always seems to go back to the Freemasons. And John Lindsay ran into this problem when he was doing his last dig. Everything was going fine. He had the city behind him. Everything was going great. And then this conversation came up about this 2.5-ton garnet stone with these hieroglyphics on it. And that was at one time in the basement of the old Rockwall Courthouse. And there were several inmates back when they used to keep inmates at the top of that place. I remember when I was a kid driving by there, and you could see the jailbirds like hanging out of the top of this, you know, this little building and stuff, and come to find out some of these inmates had seen a well-known Rockwall politician who's also a Freemason and some other gentlemen taking out this giant stone at, you know, in the middle of the night in a big heist. And John Lindsay's been told that, that the stone is still around and one day it'll resurface. And what's interesting is that as soon as he started, you know, asking who has it and found out who has it and started asking questions about it, they immediately shut everything down. His dig lost all his funding. Everything was, they completely pulled out. And he was saying, well, you know, I just was curious about this stone. Why is this such a secret? And then you come to find out that these two initial guys, Heath and Barnes, who founded Rockwall, also founded the first Masonic Lodge in Rockwall, the East Fork Masonic Lodge. And it's interesting, if you can go to their website right now, the East Fork Masonic Lodge in Rockwall. It's interesting, they have a little animated GIF wall that goes around the perimeter of their website, almost as a hint to this. Whether or not they were using these sites in Rockwall specifically, whether or not they were using these sites in any kind of rituals or anything like that, you know, I really don't have any data on that. I haven't heard anything on that. But I will tell you one thing that is interesting is that all of these ancient sites around the United States, the ancient mound sites, the earthworks, most, if not all of them, are all aligned to the winter solstices, the equinoxes, solar events. Many of them are aligned to particular star systems, such as Deneb, Cygnus, Orion. And I, one of my goals for this film was to go out to one of these sites that I visited and get footage of the either the equinox sunrise or the equinox sunset or solstice sunrise or solstice sunset, one of those, because I thought it would be great to show people in the film, not just tell them, and actually show on video the solar alignments that occur at these sites. And that's when I started to really become suspicious, Henrik, was because I started looking at all these sites, and then I went to other ones and looked at the times at which they were open, and even ones that I didn't visit. What's interesting is all of these sites where these are located, they all open in the morning well after sunrise, and they all close in the day well before sunset.
Mm-hmm.
So it's impossible. And I found out that Stonehenge is the same way. You have the high level order of druids are allowed to go out there on the solstices and sunsets and do their rituals, and people have to stand way back. And so I that's when I started thinking, you know, I bet these guys are utilizing these sites at those specific times, and that's why you and I can't get in there, because it talks about, especially with Moundville in Alabama, which was one of the sites I visited, talks yep. specifically about there being a window that happens between, like, November and April that happens at the sunrise and the sunset where, you know, you basically can traverse to these other worlds and all this stuff. And I found that really kind of suspect, you know, Henrik. You don't always try to look for a conspiracy under every rock, but when you have something like that where every single one of these sites nationwide, you know, are all inaccessible at these times, it does raise some red flags.
Yeah, it does, and it should. Now, there seems to be, the case seems to be that most of these mounds and other structures actually have been built by giants. If you look at the incredible amount of you know, these earthworks, of how much material you'd have to shovel, and if we zoom out a little bit then, Josh, and talk about the bigger picture, a possible scenario of what happened, where these giants come from or came from. I know that there's multiple different theories out there. One could even be that actually it's the mounds are placed on natural earth energy node points where we've heard story about seeds, for example, being supercharged, if you will, on these quote-unquote sacred sites because there's something to the energy there. The question is, maybe the people who actually live there managed to grow larger, bigger because of it. We don't know. They could come from somewhere else. But what I like about what you've done in the film is that you've tied it into the ancient stories about giants. And I mean, it's obviously a reference to the Genesis 6 giants, the Nephilim. They even had these double row of teeth. They had in some cases six fingers or toes. It is those stories. That's what we're talking about here.
Well, what I found was interesting was this, Henrik, and I detail this towards the end of the film, is that I would go back and I was going back and saying, I mean, I had to become really an expert in so many fields that I had never studied before in working on this. Everything from geology to ancient, near and far and far east Middle Eastern studies. I mean, I had to get into all kinds of history and things that I had never really delved into before, and I think that was actually a good thing because it gave me sort of fresh eyes looking at it. I didn't have any preconceived notions about the information before going into it. And what I found was interesting is that you had this massive just migration of these Canaanite Amorite people that were ran out of the Middle East after the fall of after the takeover of Babylon and the exodus of the Jews and all of this stuff. And you started to see between the periods of 800 A.D. and about 1100 A.D., you started to see, specifically in the West, specifically in the Americas, right in that time, which perfectly coincides with this mass migration of people from the Middle East around that area that was once called the Amorite territory that extended through the entire area that we now know as Palestine and all of Mesopotamia, really Iraq, all that stuff. And that around that time was when you started to see there was something going on between those years where you started to have mounds and ceremonial sites popping up all over the United States that never popped up here before, even though you had centuries of indigenous populations and indigenous tribes existing in the United States long before. So why did these mounds and why did these sites start to pop up overnight? The reason you started to see these pop up overnight is because you started to see a massive influx of peoples that were coming from other areas of the world that were coming and essentially wanting to find a new place. And I think that this time period, they seem to have existed for a few hundred years, and then there seems to be an event that is coincidentally described in many Native American traditions where there was some sort of an extermination, where these guys, these giants came from faraway lands. They were here. Some of them seemed to be benevolent, seemed to want to help the indigenous populations, give them knowledge, set them up with religion, teach them how to plant. And then you had other ones that seemed to be, very overbearing and in some cases cannibals. And so there seems to be an extermination. And that is what is fascinating about the mound sites, is this idea that you had these people who at one point were appreciated, but then later they seemed to become a threat to the indigenous populations. And one of the things that that really, really struck me about going out and visiting a place like Moundville, Alabama, as you mentioned, the sheer amount of people and work that it would take to build these sites, it just doesn't make sense that it was built by regular small people. I mean, the story at Moundville is that they spent 300 years building these mound structures. Jeez. And then as soon as these were done being built, all of the people in that area completely disappeared. And when you look at the stories that talk about these alignments being aligned with these portals of souls, and because when they first found Moundville, Alabama, they thought it was a death cult. I mean, they called it the Southern Death Cult for a long period of time, but the thing about it is they weren't particularly finding mass amounts of mass sacrificial rituals or anything like that. It didn't make any sense that they were calling it the Southern Death Cult when they weren't finding mass amounts of rituals. What they were finding was in these mounds, they were finding giant skeletons, and they were finding strange anomalous artifacts that had symbols on them that were pertaining to Syrian symbology found in Oklahoma. You had, all this Phoenician iconography found in Oklahoma. I actually talked to a gentleman a couple of years ago. I was up in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, and this is before I started this film project, and I was up there with the band I used to play in. And the Tahlequah, Oklahoma, by the way, is the seat of the Cherokee Nation. And this gentleman was telling me about how, a long time ago, this is what the Cherokee believe, Phoenicians came up to Oklahoma through waterways in boats and seeded our tribe with a written language. That's why the Cherokee are the only tribe with a written language. And they gave us all this knowledge and this, that, and the other. And I had never heard this. And when I started researching for the film and working on all this and looking at the mass amounts of Phoenician-style buildings and artifacts that have been found in Oklahoma and Texas and all over the United States, that's when I started to realize that, let's go back and see, were there giants that were said to exist in this area of what was Phoenicia and Canaan and all of this. And, of course, all of those people that inhabited those lands, yes, were said indeed to be giants. So that's what it became pretty clear to me, Henrik, that these people, whoever they were, these giants that came from that area, were here in the United States, and they seem to have set up the tribal structure of the Native Americans in the exact same way that the lost tribes of Israel were set up. And that was just a highly, highly interesting revelation.
And they're kind of where it dovetails a little bit with, you know, some of the Mormon theology and all that as well. But the story of Beowulf that we have up here in the North is basically a carbon copy of many of the North American stories as well, of these, you know, red-haired giants, basically. I mean, in the Beowulf story, Grendel, who is the big giant, is killed by Beowulf that comes from an area where we're headquartered in south to midwestern Sweden right now. And it's just so interesting that you have this connection with these rune scripts also found in America, in many parts of the world. Ohio, there's the Kensington rune stone. It just goes on and on and on, and the connections are just, they're far and wide. And I mean, what else than diffusionism could explain this, Josh? What do you think?
Well, absolutely, and to give people an idea of what you're talking about, what do you mean that? I haven't seen the film yet. The two predominant schools of thought when it comes to these issues is you have diffusionism and you have isolationism. And isolationism is the track that of course mainstream science and other institutions such as the Smithsonian have taken. And that idea states that cultures had no outside contact with each other whatsoever. And I mean, they even take it to the extreme to when you actually have proof of it, they still say it's not possible. But diffusionism supports the idea that cultures throughout the world had contact with each other, and that at various stages through time, there have been people all over the world from different areas going to different parts of the world and seeding indigenous populations with knowledge of religion, science, astrology, farming, all of this stuff, as almost an altruistic thing. But that you also start to see the roots of religion and how, you know, if these giants were not, let's say, you know, let's say for a minute that they aren't Nephilim or they aren't, you know, Anunnaki or whatever people want to say they are.
Yeah.
Regardless of all that, if you were a giant and you had knowledge and information that indigenous populations who didn't have that information had, I mean, you would be seen as a god. You would be revered as a god. If you showed up and you're a giant and you start teaching these people and showing them how to properly grow crops, you start teaching them about religion, about invocation, about how to use nature and the earth in your advantage and work in tandem with it and set everything up around that. Yeah, sure, these people are going to see you as a god all day long. And I think that to me, Henrik, is the most important thing to focus in on, regardless of what you believe their origins is or whatever it may be. The most important thing is that it's not a surprise and it's not a shock and it's not out of the realms of believability that anyone with a giant stature and a great deal of information is going to have a potential to set themselves up as a great and powerful being. That's all there is to it.
Oh, definitely. And if we simplify for a moment, there seems to be quote-unquote good, quote-unquote bad giants as well, actually. And you have an idea about this. I really like that one. I want to talk more about that. Two different races of giants. They look somewhat similar, but there's differences between them. And there seems to have been some kind of schism here. Explain this a little bit.
Well, that was another shocking revelation for me. It was also something that was causing a lot of confusion because I would find, as you said, I would find these reports. The report of some of these seem to be these dark-headed giants with double rows of teeth that are very, in some cases, cannibalistic. I know in the Rockwall Success reports, they said they found a some sort of big pot full of cooked human bones.
Yeah.
You know, there's all these reports from the Native American tribes about the savage black hairs, and then they talk also about a race of red hairs that came across. And then another thing that blew me away that I found out, which I didn't know because I really never paid much attention to the whole Mormon thing really at all, didn't really study it, But once I started finding out that, you know, their entire basis of their thing and their religion is based on this idea that there was these two tribes, one of black-haired giants and one of red hairs, and a battle in the order for another one to wipe the other one out, it just became very, very startling to me. And the idea that these golden plates of the Mormons were found in these mounds, and it just really gave me the idea that, okay, you know, there's something to this, but what they're telling us that there is to it is, I don't think, the real truth. There's more to it than what the Mormon religion says there is. There's more to it. But that's the whole thing is, if it's Mormonism or it's Christianity or it's the Freemasons, when you really study it and you get down to it, all these guys are the same thing anyway. I mean, they're all come from the same origins, from the same roots that go back to the Babylonian mystery schools, the Brotherhood of the Snake. They come from the same tribes out of Israel. I mean, Brigham Young, Joseph Smith, they were all of the Levite bloodline that went back to ancient Israel. But the idea of there being two separate races of giants really struck me from the reports of them being found in mounds. And what you seem to have find the most of, the most predominant ones are the red-headed giants, but there's also these dark-headed giants as well. And the natives have stories of a great war that happened. And essentially what they claim is that these dark-head giants actually existed and were actually here in the United States, what we know as the United States, before the red man arrived. And that when they arrived here across the alleged Bering Strait land bridge, mm-hmm. they found already inhabiting this area these cannibalistic giants. So they had to, who knows, you know, how many of them got wiped out, but essentially they had to hide themselves. This very well could be where these, as we were talking about earlier, the usage of these underground tunnel systems around the rock wall, this very well could be where that came from. Yep. And then they also tell about a benevolent red-haired race who came from the east. Specifically, they said they came from the east, and they did not want to harm the indigenous people. And in fact, for all intents and purposes, for the what you see in the film, the DNA evidence supports the idea that there was a lot of commingling going on, a lot of breeding happening here with between these giants and the smaller indigenous populations. And this is how the indigenous people got all of their tribal rituals, all of their religious ceremonies, and at some point they just had enough and banded with these red-haired giants and wiped out this race they called the Ranogwetawanka, which is what the indigenous populations refer to as these black, dark-headed giants. And then it seems that at some point as well, the red-haired giants, who were initially seen as a help, were eventually seen as taking over too much land. They were usurping too much land from the natives, and they were eventually wiped out by the native populations as well. There's many stories of the Lovelock Caves in Nevada where they had cornered some of these. The natives had cornered some of these red-haired giants, and they basically lit a fire and smoked them out, and later, many years later, people went in and found these remains in there. But, it really does seem that there was an extermination of these giants because they were seen as a threat, but at the same time, they seemed to have a knowledge that was very important at giving the indigenous populations of the United States some sort of culture. And this is why when you started to have the colonization effect happened in the United States and people started coming across the West. Initially, with Manifest Destiny, you had this declaring of all Native Americans as being savages, as being having nothing worth preserving, and there being a separate race. This was the scientifically held, established belief that there was a separate race of mound builders who built these mounds, who built all these earthworks, who were very sophisticated, who seeded the Native American Indians, gave them culture, gave them knowledge. And then, once they got Manifest Destiny, and they came and they claimed all the land, and then everybody started kind of saying, okay, well, we, you know, now we feel bad. Well, we wiped all of them out, but there's still some left, so we want to give them their reservations, and we want to make this not look as bad. So what they did was, they switched that around and said, okay, we were wrong. The Native Americans actually do have stuff worth preserving. They actually weren't savages. And by the way, they built all of these mounds and all of these earthworks. And if you say otherwise, you're a racist.
Yeah.
I mean, they completely changed this thing because at that point, they had all the land anyway, so it didn't matter.
Yeah. It's incredible. We have no idea about the complexity of history and the consequent rewritings. When I think back to this time, the ancient Earth and what really, you know, the conditions was like here, I get a very eerie feeling when you really start setting your mind into it. It's fascinating, of course, and it's exciting, but it's also something. There seems to be something dark there because there's these different wars that have been going on between different types of humans, or even if we are talking about and some kind of alien race or, you know, mankind planted here or whatever it is. It's just fascinating. We're going to take a break here now between the segments, Josh. But before we do that, I just want to, of course, bring up some of the details here. The film we're talking about is called The Lost Secrets of Ancient America. And this is the first volume. And you can let us know, Josh, if you know even at this point how many volumes you have in store here. But if you find this interesting, you should, of course, pick up a copy of the Blu-ray or the DVD, and tell us where to go and where to do this, Josh.
Okay, great. And you can go to my website, theglobalreality.com. You can also just type Josh Reeves into a search engine, and mine will be the first website that comes up there, theglobalreality.com. Right now we have digital downloads. You can get it in two different qualities. You can get it in a standard HD, about a 4.7 gig file. It's a 3-hour and 34-minute movie, so it's chock full of info. You can also get it in a higher quality Blu-ray quality for $25 there at my website. I'm actually going to do a special here exclusively for Red Ice Radio listeners. The first 20 people that hear this broadcast and go and get themselves a digital download at my website are not only going to get the digital download, they're also going to get a DVD sent to them free of charge. So that's something I want to do special for the great listeners
Thank
of
you,
Red
Josh.
Ice Radio, because the people that support your work, Henrik, and help you stay alive and keep going out there also inadvertently help my work as well, and it's a great thing. But we're also going to have the probably by the time people hear this, we'll have the discs up there for sale as well. And as far as how many volumes of there's going to be, as many as it takes. I mean, this is really just the opening salvo.
Sure.
And I'm hoping to have some various archaeological digs on the rock wall and other sites, and to also document that in the film. So this really is just the intro, and man, I'm just fired up about this show, and can't wait to get into more with you.
Definitely, there's some great material in this movie, this film. I hope you get it if you want to hear more, because it's really, really worth it. And this expose of the stories of the giants from these ancient papers, but you know, we're going back to 18 and 1900s and such. It's just, you know, so valuable. It's excellent stuff. So again, theglobalreality.com is the website, and we'll have that linked up, of course, on redascreations.com. We'll carry on with Josh in the next segment, so stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back.
with us in the second hour, you're going to hear more about the bogus story of Christopher Columbus discovering America. We'll speak more about the mysteries surrounding the rock wall in Texas. Josh tells us where he thinks the rocks used to build the wall came from. And later we talk about other mysterious, ancient, powerful sites in America and the symbolism connected to them. Please go to redicemembers.com and click on subscribe now to sign up for a membership and continue to listen to the second hour with Josh Reeves. You'll get instant access to our archives of now almost 800 interviews and growing every week on all kinds of different topics. We'll proceed right now with Josh Reeves. If this is your stop, please catch us next time when we have Suzanne Posel from Occupy Corporatism with us. After this, Paul Connett, director of the Fluoride Action Network. We have much more coming after this, and you're of course free to tune in when it works best for you. From our website, you can stream or download our programs. We have RSS feeds and apps and much more. We'll be right back.